that is present. However, dark energy, the mysterious form of energy that the previous chapter discussed, which is present in the universe but not carried by any form of matter, influences these fluctuations too. But the true discovery of dark energy came from supernova measurements made by two separate teams of physicists, one led by Saul Perlmutter and the other by Adam Riess and Brian Schmidt. This discovery is a minor detour, since dark matter will be our true concern. But dark energy, too, is interesting and important enough to be worth a brief detour here. Type 1A supernovae and the discovery of dark energy. Type 1A supernovae played an especially important role in the discovery of dark energy. Type 1A supernovae result from the nuclear explosions of white dwarfs, which are the seemingly innocuous end states of some star's evolution after they have burned up all the hydrogen and helium at their core via thermonuclear fusion. Above a certain mass, white dwarfs become unstable and explode. Like an oil-rich country that has exported away all its resources and finds itself saddled with a dense, dissatisfied population on the brink of revolution, white dwarfs absorb only so much material before their mass sets them on the verge of exploding, too. Because the white dwarfs that explode to produce them all have the same mass, type 1A supernovae all shine with about the same brightness, making them what astrophysicists refer to as standard candles. Type 1A supernovae are a particularly useful probe of the universe's expansion rate because of this uniformity, and also because they are bright and relatively easy to see, even when far away. On top of that, they are standard candles, so their apparent brightness varies only because of their different distances from us. So, if astronomers measure both the speed with which a galaxy is receding and the galaxy's luminosity, they can determine the expansion rate of the universe in which the galaxy is carried, as well as how far away the galaxy is. Armed with this information, they can determine the universe's expansion as a function of time. Two teams of supernovae researchers used this insight to discover dark energy in 1998, when they measured the redshifts of the galaxies in which the Type 1A supernovae reside. The redshift is the shift in the frequency of the light that a receding object emits, which, like the lowering of the pitch of an ambulance's siren when it's racing away, tells how quickly something moves from a source of light or sound. Knowing both the redshifts and the brightness of the supernovae they studied, researchers could measure the universe's expansion rate. Much to their surprise, they found that supernovae were dimmer than anticipated, indicating that the supernovae were farther away than they had expected, according to then-conventional assumptions about the universe's expansion rate. Their observations led to the remarkable conclusion that some unanticipated energy source was accelerating the rate of the universe's expansion. Dark energy fits the bill, since its gravitational influence makes the universe expand at an increasingly rapid rate over time. Along with measurements in the cosmic microwave background, the supernovae measurements established the existence of dark energy. Dark matter coda. Today, the agreement among all measurements is so good that cosmologists talk of a lambda CDM paradigm, where CDM is an acronym for cold dark matter. Lambda is the name that is sometimes used for the dark energy that we know now to be present. With dark energy, dark matter, and ordinary matter distributed as in the cosmic pie, all measurements to date agree with predictions. The precisely measured cosmic microwave background radiation, with its minuscule but rich density perturbations, establishes many cosmological parameters, including the energy densities of ordinary matter, dark matter, and dark energy, as well as the universe's age and shape. The excellent agreement of the more recent data from the WMAP and Planck satellites that we will consider in Chapter 5, and with the data from other observations, such as that obtained by studying Type 1A supernovae, is an important verification of the cosmological model. But there is one final, very important piece of evidence for the existence of dark matter that I have yet to address. This one, probably the most important to us, is the existence of structure such as galaxies. Without dark matter, such structure wouldn't have had time to form. To appreciate dark matter's pivotal role in this important process requires some understanding of the earlier stages of the universe's history. So before I explain the formation of structure, Let's first turn to cosmology, the study of how the universe changed over time. Chapter 3. The Big Questions. A couple of times when I've told people that I work on cosmology, they have mistaken me for a cosmetologist, which I find very funny given how poorly suited I would be for this vocation. But the mistake did motivate me to look up these words, which, if you are not listening closely, can sound strikingly similar. The Online Etymology Dictionary, which explained that both words originated in the Latinized version of the Greek cosmos, taught me that the mistake is almost justifiable. Pythagoras of Samos in the 6th century BC might have been the first to use cosmos to apply to the universe, but from around AD 1200, the meaning of cosmos was order, good order, or orderly arrangement. The word didn't gain traction, however, until the mid-19th century, when the German scientist and explorer Alexander von Humboldt gave a series of lectures, which he wrote up in a treatise titled Cosmos. This treatise influenced many readers, including the writers Emerson, Thoreau, Poe, and Whitman. You might joke that Carl Sagan did the original rebooting of the popular Cosmos series. The word cosmetic, on the other hand, traces back to the 1640s, derived from the French cosmétique, which in turn descended from the Greek cosmetikos, meaning skilled in adornment or arrangement. The online dictionary, presenting a dual meaning that I suspect only Los Angeles residents can fully understand, explains, thus, cosmos had an important secondary sense of ornaments, a woman's dress, decoration, as well as the universe, the world. In any case, the similarity and embarrassing confusion that I encountered was not entirely a coincidence. Both cosmology and cosmetology derive from cosmos. Like a face, the universe has both beauty and an underlying order. Cosmology, the science of the evolution of the universe, has now truly come into its own. It has recently entered an era in which revolutionary advances, both experimental and theoretical, have yielded a more extensive and detailed understanding than most people would have thought possible even 30 years ago. Improved technology, combined with theories rooted in general relativity and particle physics, have provided a detailed picture of the universe's earlier stages and of how it evolved into the universe we currently see. The next chapter explains how far and deep these 20th century advances have taken us in our understanding of the universe's history. But before exploring these remarkable achievements, I want to first briefly wax philosophical in order to make clear what science does and does not tell us about the answers to some of humanity's oldest and most fundamental questions. Questions without answers. Cosmology is about big inquiries, nothing less than how the universe began and subsequently developed into its current state. Prior to the scientific revolution, people tried to answer such questions with the only methods at their disposal, namely philosophy and limited observations. Some ideas they had turned out to be correct, but not surprisingly, many others were wrong. Today, too, despite our many advances, people can't help turning to philosophy when thinking about the universe and the questions we haven't yet answered, in effect forcing us to confront the distinction between philosophy and science. Science concerns those ideas that at least in principle we can verify or rule out through experiments and observations. Philosophy, to a scientist at least, concerns questions we expect we will never reliably answer. Technology sometimes lags behind, but we'd like to believe that at least in principle, scientific proposals will be verified or ruled out. This leaves scientists with a dilemma. The universe almost certainly extends beyond the domain we can observe. If indeed the speed of light is finite, and if our universe has been around for only a fixed amount of time, we can access only a finite region of space, no matter how much technology might advance. We can see only those regions that can be reached via a light ray, or something else that travels at light speed, during the lifetime of the universe. Only from those regions can a signal possibly reach us within the time that the universe has been around. Anything farther away, beyond what physicists call the cosmic horizon, is inaccessible to any observation we could make at this time. This means that science in its truest form doesn't apply beyond this domain. No one can experimentally validate or rule out conjectures that apply beyond the horizon. According to our definition of science, For those faraway regions, philosophy reigns supreme. This doesn't mean that curious scientists never ponder the big questions about the physical principles or processes that apply there. Indeed, many do. I don't want to dismiss such inquiries. They can often be deep and fascinating. But given the limitations, you can't trust scientists' answers about this domain, at least not more than anyone else's. However, since I'm so often asked, I'll use this chapter to offer my take on a few of the big questions people often want addressed. One question I frequently hear is why there is something rather than nothing. Though none of us knows the true reason, I'll give my two responses. The first, which is undeniable, is that you wouldn't be here to ask this question, and I wouldn't be here to answer it if there were nothing. But my other answer is that I just think something is more likely. After all, nothing is very special. If you have a number line, zero is just one infinitesimal point among the infinity of possible numbers you can choose. Nothing is so special that without an underlying reason, you wouldn't expect it to characterize the state of the universe. But even an underlying reason is something. You at least need physical laws to explain a very non-random occurrence. A cause implies there must be something. Though it sounds like a joke, I really believe this. You might not always find what you are looking for, but you don't randomly find nothing. But there is also a scientific rather than a philosophical question that comes up when physicists consider the matter we are made of, the stuff we are supposed to understand. Why in our universe do we have as much of the matter we are made of, protons, neutrons, electrons, as we do? Though we understand a great deal about ordinary matter, we don't fully understand why so much of it is still here. The amount of energy in ordinary matter is an unsolved problem. We don't yet know why it has survived as abundantly as it has to today. The problem boils down to the question of why there wasn't always an equal amount of matter and antimatter. Antimatter is the stuff with the same mass but opposite charges to ordinary matter. Physical theories tell us that for every matter particle, an antimatter particle must exist. For example, knowing that an electron has charge -1 tells us there must also be an antiparticle, it's called a positron, with the same mass but opposite charge, +1. To avoid any confusion, let me state explicitly that antimatter is not dark matter. Antimatter carries the same types of charges as ordinary matter and therefore interacts with light. The only difference is that the antimatter charges are the opposite to those of the associated matter. Because antimatter carries opposite charges to our usual matter, the net charge of matter and antimatter is zero. Since matter and antimatter together carry no charge, charge conservation and Einstein's famous formula E equals mc square tells us that matter can meet up with antimatter to disappear into pure energy, which also has no charge. We would have expected that as the universe cooled, essentially all known matter would have annihilated with antimatter, meaning matter and antimatter would have combined to turn into pure energy and thereby disappeared. But as we are here to discuss the question, clearly this was not the case. We are left with matter, that 5% of the universe's energy that you see in Figure 3 from the enhancement, so the amount of matter in the universe must be greater than the amount of antimatter. A critical feature for our universe and ourselves is that in contrast to standard thermal expectations, ordinary matter sticks around and survives in sufficient quantities to create animals and cities and stars. This is possible only because matter dominates over antimatter. There is a matter-antimatter asymmetry. If the amounts had always been equal, matter and antimatter would have found each other, annihilated, and disappeared. In order to have matter stick around until today, an asymmetry between matter and antimatter had to have been established at some time in the early universe. Physicists have suggested many workable scenarios for what could have created this imbalance, but we don't yet know which, if any, of these ideas are correct. The origin of the asymmetry remains one of the important unsolved problems in cosmology. This means that not only do we not understand the dark components, but we don't even fully understand ordinary matter, the small piece of the cosmic pie that represents known matter. Something special had to have occurred early in the evolution of the universe to explain why this piece of pie remains. A second currently unanswerable question is what exactly happened during the Big Bang. Scientists and the popular press frequently refer to the Big Bang explosion that happened back when the universe was less than 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, and the universe was 10 to the minus 33 centimeters big, and even illustrate the explosion with gorgeous multicolored images. But the term Big Bang is misleading, as I will further discuss in the chapter that follows. The astronomer Fred Hoyle, who preferred a static universe, invented the term in 1949 as a pejorative for his use on his BBC radio show to refer to this theory that he didn't believe. Regardless of your attitude toward Big Bang cosmology, which very successfully describes the universe's evolution only a fraction of a second after the universe we know began, no one knows what happened at that earliest moment. A reliable characterization of the Big Bang, and possibly what happened before, requires a theory of quantum gravity. On the tiny distance scales that are relevant to this earliest time, both quantum mechanics and gravity are important, and no one has yet found a solvable theory that applies to this infinitesimal distance regime. We will gain insight into the very beginning of the universe only when we know more about physical processes on this tiny distance scale, and even then, observations to validate the conclusions will very likely be impossible. An even more impossible to answer question I often hear is what came before the Big Bang? Answering this presumably requires even more knowledge than understanding the Big Bang itself. We don't know what happened at the time of the Big Bang, and neither I nor anyone else knows what came before. But before you become too disappointed by this omission, let me reassure you that you would probably find any answer to this question unsatisfactory. Either the universe was around an infinite length of time, or it started at some particular time. Both answers can seem disturbing, but those are the options. Taking this a step further, if the universe existed forever, and the Big Bang was part of it, either our universe was all there was, or other universes also emerged from their own Big Bangs. The multiverse is the name associated with a cosmos in which, in addition to our own universe, there are many others. In this scenario, there would be many different expanding regions, each constituting its own universe. This reasoning leaves us with three choices. Either our universe started with a Big Bang, the universe has been around forever but eventually went over to the expansion that the Big Bang theory predicts, or we are one of many universes that grew out of a universe multiverse that has always existed. This covers all the possibilities. The last one seems most likely to me, in that it doesn't assume that our world or even our particular universe is special, which is reasoning that has been invoked since the time of Copernicus. This choice also implies that just as the spatial extent of the universe, at least to my way of thinking, is more likely to be infinite than finite in size, the evolving universe is unlikely to have a beginning or end in time, even though our particular universe might. The existence of multiple emerging and eventually disappearing universes is probably the least unsatisfying of three not completely graspable possibilities. This brings me to the last philosophical inquiry, prompted by the one above, which is whether such a multiverse exists. Existing physical theories suggest that multiverses are rather likely, especially given the many possible solutions in quantum gravity theories as currently formulated. Whether or not those calculations stand up to scrutiny, I would wager that other inaccessible universes should be present. Why shouldn't they? Given that we know the limitations of physical laws and current technology, it is both figuratively and literally short-sighted to decide they aren't there. Nothing about our world is inconsistent with the existence of a multiverse. But that doesn't mean we will ever know. If nothing travels faster than the speed of light, any region that is too far away, beyond the cosmic horizon, is off-limits to observations. Yet these other regions could in principle contain other universes that are completely separate from our own. Some signals of other universes could potentially be found in the cases where over time separate universes come into contact. But this is highly unlikely, and in general, other universes are inaccessible. For my faithful returning readers, I'll now make an aside to be clear that in discussing multiverses, I am not referring to the multidimensional scenarios that I described in Warped Passages. universes might also exist that are closer than the horizon, but that are separated from us across another dimension of space, a dimension beyond the three that we observe, left-right, up-down, and forward-backward. Although no one has yet seen such a dimension, it might exist, and in principle, a universe separated from us along this dimension might as well. This type of universe is known as a brain world. As those who read my first book know, the brain worlds that interest me most could potentially have observable consequences, because they are not necessarily so far away. However, brain worlds are generally not what people mean when discussing the more general multiverse scenario involving many separate universes that won't interact even via gravity. Multiverses are so far away that even something traveling at the speed of light from one of these other universes wouldn't have time to reach us in the lifetime of our universe. Nonetheless, there is a lot of interest in the multiverse idea in the popular imagination. I was recently talking to a friend who was very excited about the idea of a multiverse and didn't understand why I didn't necessarily find it as interesting as he did. For me, the first reason is the one stated above. In all likelihood, we will never know with certainty whether or not we live in a multiverse. Even if other universes exist, they are likely to remain undetectable. My friend found this only mildly disappointing, and his interest persisted. I suspect that he, along with many others, likes the idea because he thinks a copy of himself is living in one of these distant realms. Just for the record, I don't hold this view. If other universes exist, they are most likely nothing like our own. They probably don't even contain the same forms of matter or forces as we do. If there were life there, we most likely wouldn't even recognize it and probably couldn't detect it in the first place, even if it weren't so far away. The infinite number of confluences that create any single human being would be even less likely. After I explained how, even with many other universes, there can be an even larger universe of possibilities, my friend began to see my point. In fact, even if the multiverse scenario holds, most of the other universes will be untenable and will either collapse or explode, in which case they will dilute to nothing almost instantaneously. Only a few, like our own, might last long enough to develop structure and perhaps even life. Despite Copernicus's insightful perspective, our particular universe does seem to have a number of peculiar properties, ones that permit galaxies, the solar system, and life. Some people try to explain the special properties of our universe by assuming the existence of multiple universes, at least one of which has the special properties we require for our existence. Many who think this way attempt anthropic reasoning, which tries to justify particular properties of our universe on the grounds that they are essential to life, or at least galaxies that can support life. The problem here is that we don't know which properties are anthropically determined and which are based on fundamental physical laws, or which properties are essential to life and which are simply essential to the life that we see. Anthropic reasoning might be correct in some cases, but we have the usual problem that we don't know how to test the ideas. In all likelihood, we will only rule out such ideas if a better, more predictive idea takes its place. Ideas such as those discussed above are speculations. They are intriguing, but we won't have answers, at least not any time soon. In my research, I prefer to think about the multiverse of communities of matter that's right here, and which we can hope to understand. I'm using the term metaphorically, but it's not so far from the truth. A universe of dark matter is right under our noses, yet we don't generally interact with it, and we don't yet know what it is. But theoretical and experimental physicists are currently advancing our knowledge about what this dark universe might be. Someday soon, we might know the answer, and such a discovery would be worth the wait. Chapter 4. Almost the very beginning. A very good place to start. A rather funny and outspoken Russian theoretical physicist startled everyone over coffee recently when he was describing the colloquium he was planning for the following week. A physics colloquium is a general talk that is geared toward students, postdoctoral fellows, and professors, all of whom have a background in physics, though not necessarily with a focus in the speaker's more narrowly defined field. This particular physicist's description of his proposed colloquium was, "I will talk about cosmology." When it was pointed out this might be a bit broad, after all, cosmology is an entire discipline, he argued that there are only a few ideas and quantities worth measuring in cosmology, and he could cover all of them, along with his own contributions, in an hour-long talk. I'll let you be the judge of whether this extreme view of cosmology is actually true. For the record, I'm doubtful. Many issues remain to be explored and understood. But indeed, part of the beauty of the universe's early evolution is that in many respects, it is surprisingly simple. By looking at the single sky that astronomers and physicists observe and study today, we can extrapolate facts about the composition and activities of the universe billions of years ago. In this chapter, we'll explore the stunning progress in our understanding of the universe's history that the past century's beautiful theories and measurements have brought us. The Big Bang Theory. We don't have the tools to reliably characterize the very beginning. But not knowing how the universe started doesn't mean that we don't know quite a lot. Unlike its very beginning, which no known theory can describe, the universe's evolution, only a tiny fraction of a second after its beginning, hewed to establish laws of physics. By applying the equations of relativity and using simplifying assumptions about the universe's contents, physicists can determine a great deal about the universe's behavior only a minuscule interval after it began, perhaps 10 to the minus 36 seconds or so later, at which time the Big Bang Theory, which describes the expansion of the universe, applies. The universe at this early time was filled with matter and radiation that was uniform and isotropic, the same at all places and in all directions, so only a few quantities suffice to describe its early physical properties. This characterization makes the early evolution of the universe simple, predictable, and understandable. The linchpin of the Big Bang Theory is the universe's expansion. In the 1920s and 1930s, the Russian meteorologist Alexander Friedman, the Belgian priest and physicist Georges Lemaître, the American mathematician and physicist Howard Percy Robertson, and the British mathematician Arthur Geoffrey Walker, the last two working together, solved Einstein's equations of general relativity and deduced that the universe must grow or contract with the passage of time. They moreover calculated how the expansion rate of space would respond to the gravitational influence of matter and radiation, both of whose energy densities change too as the universe evolves. The expansion of the universe is perhaps an odd concept, given that the universe has very likely been infinite all along, but it is space itself that is expanding, meaning that the distance between objects like galaxies increases with time. I am frequently asked, if the universe is expanding, what is it expanding into? The answer is that it is not expanding into anything. Space itself grows. Figure 4 on the enhancement illustrates this. If you imagine the universe as the surface of a balloon, the balloon itself stretches. If you had marked two points on the balloon's surface, those two points would grow farther apart, just as galaxies recede from each other in an expanding universe. Our analogy isn't perfect, since the surface of the balloon is only two-dimensional, and it does in fact expand into three-dimensional space. The analogy works only if you imagine that the balloon's surface is all there is. It is space itself. If this were true, even with nothing else already there to expand into, the marked points would nevertheless still grow apart. The Balloon-iverse. For the analogy to be even better, only the space between the marked points would expand, not the points themselves. Even in an expanding universe, stars or planets or anything else that is sufficiently tightly bound by other forces or by stronger gravitational effects won't experience the expansion that drives galaxies apart from each other. Atoms, which consist of a nucleus and electrons that are kept in close proximity by the electromagnetic force, don't get any bigger. Neither do relatively dense, strongly bound structures such as galaxies, or our own bodies for that matter, which have a density in excess of a trillion times the mean density of the universe. The force driving the expansion acts on all these dense, bound systems too, but because other force contributions are so much more powerful, our bodies and the galaxies don't grow with the universe's expansion, or if they do, it is by such a negligible amount that we would never notice or measure the effect. Matter that is bound more strongly than the force driving the expansion remains the same size. It is only the distance between such objects that gets bigger as the growing space drives them farther apart. Einstein famously first derived the expansion of the universe from his equations of relativity. He did so, however, before any expansion was measured, so he didn't accept or advocate his result. In an attempt to reconcile his theory's predictions with a static universe, Einstein introduced a new source of energy that looked to him like it could thwart the predicted expansion. Edwin Hubble proved this kludge misguided in 1929 when he discovered that the universe was indeed expanding, with galaxies moving farther away from each other over time. Though, incredibly, as an observer who didn't trust any particular theory, he didn't accept this interpretation of his results. Einstein readily dispensed with the fudge he had made, and is known, perhaps apocryphally, to have called it his biggest blunder. The modification was not entirely erroneous, however, in that the type of energy that Einstein proposed does exist. More recent measurements have shown that the new type of energy he added, which we now call dark energy, though not of the magnitude or of a type that would curb the expansion of the universe, is actually necessary to account for recent observations of precisely the opposite effect, the universe's accelerated expansion. But I think Einstein really thought his blunder, if indeed he actually called it that, was in not recognizing the correctness and significance of his initial expansion prediction, which could have been viewed as a key prediction of his theory. In fairness, before Hubble presented his results, very little was known about the universe. Harlow Shapley had measured the size of the Milky Way to be 300,000 light-years across, but he was convinced that the Milky Way was all that the universe contained. In the 1920s, Hubble realized that this was not true when he discovered that many nebulae, which Shapley had thought were clouds of dust that merited this uninspiring name, were in fact other galaxies millions of light-years away. Toward the end of the decade, Hubble made his even more famous discovery, the redshift of galaxies, the shift in frequency of light that told scientists the universe was expanding. The redshift of galaxies, like the lowering in pitch of a moving ambulance's siren that tells us it is moving away, demonstrated that other galaxies were receding from ours, indicating that we live in a universe in which galaxies grow farther apart. Today, we sometimes talk about a Hubble constant, which is the rate at which the universe currently expands. It is a constant in the sense that today, its value everywhere in space is the same. But actually, the Hubble parameter is not constant. It changes with time. Earlier in the universe, when things were denser and gravitational effects were stronger, the universe expanded far more rapidly than it does today. Until rather recently, a fairly broad range of measured values for the Hubble parameter, which quantifies the expansion rate today, meant we could not precisely pin down the universe's age. The lifetime of the universe depends on the inverse of the Hubble parameter, so if that measurement is uncertain by a factor of 2, so too is its age. I remember reading in the newspaper when I was a kid that some recent measurements had caused the age of the universe to be revised by this amount. Not knowing this represented the expansion rate measurement, I remember my astonishment at the radical revision. How could something as important as the age of the universe have been at liberty to change? It turns out we can understand a good deal of the universe's evolution at a qualitative level, even without knowing its precise age. But better knowledge of its age does foster a better understanding of the universe's contents and the underlying physical processes at work. This uncertainty is in any case now under much better control. Wendy Friedman, who was then at the Carnegie Observatories, and her collaborators measured the expansion rate and ultimately quelled the debate. In fact, because the value of the Hubble parameter is so important for cosmology, a concerted effort was made to ensure the greatest accuracy possible. Using the Hubble Space Telescope, given the name it seems only fair, astronomers measured a value of 72 kilometers per second per megaparsec, meaning something at a distance of a megaparsec moves away at 72 kilometers per second, with an accuracy of 11%, a far cry from Hubble's original and very inaccurate measurement of 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec. A megaparsec, MPC, is a million parsecs, and a parsec, like many astronomical units, is an historical relic from the way the distances were measured in early times. It is a shortened version of parallax second and has to do with the angle subtended by an object on the sky, which is why it has an angular unit in it. Although many astronomers still use the units, as they do with many other non-intuitive historically motivated measures, most people prefer not to think in terms of parsecs. To convert to what is perhaps a slightly more familiar measure of distance, a parsec is about 3.3 light years. It is a fortuitous coincidence that the arcane measure is roughly equivalent to the more readily interpreted quantity. The Hubble telescope's more accurate result for the Hubble parameter might have been uncertain by 10 to 15%, but it was not uncertain by a factor of 2. More recent results, relying on measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation data, do even better. The age of the universe is now known to within a couple of 100 million years, and measurements have continued to improve. When I wrote my first book, it was 13.7 billion years old, but we now believe it to be a bit older, 13.8 billion years, from the so-called Big Bang. Note that it is not only the changing Hubble parameter, but the discovery of the dark energy that I mentioned in Chapter 1 that led to this more refined result, since the age of the universe depends on both. Predictions of Big Bang evolution. According to the Big Bang theory, the very early universe originated 13.8 billion years ago as a hot, dense fireball consisting of many interacting particles with temperature higher than a trillion trillion degrees. All known and presumably as yet unknown particles zipped around everywhere at close to the speed of light, constantly interacting, annihilating, and being created from energy in accordance with Einstein's theory. All types of matter that interacted sufficiently strongly with each other had a common temperature. Physicists call the hot, dense gas that filled the universe in its early stages radiation. For cosmological purposes, radiation is defined as anything that moves at relativistic speeds, which means at or very close to the speed of light. To count as radiation, objects have to possess so much momentum that their energy far exceeds the energy stored in their mass. The early universe was so outrageously hot and energetic that the gas of fundamental particles that comprised it readily satisfied this criterion. Only fundamental particles were present in this universe, and not, for example, atoms, which are made of nuclei bound together with electrons, or protons, that are made from the more fundamental particles called quarks. Nothing could remain trapped in a bound object in the face of so much heat and energy. As space expanded, the radiation and particles that permeated the universe became more dilute and cooled down. They behaved like hot air trapped inside a balloon, which becomes less dense and cooler as the balloon expands. Because each energy component's gravitational influence affects the expansion differently, the study of the universe's expansion over time allows astronomers to disentangle the separate contributions of radiation, matter, and dark energy. Matter and radiation dilute with the expansion, but radiation, which redshifts to lower energy, much like a siren decreases in frequency as it moves away, dilutes even more rapidly than matter. Dark energy, on the other hand, doesn't dilute at all. As the universe cooled, notable events occurred when its temperature and energy density no longer sufficed to produce a particular particle. This happened at times when a particle's kinetic energy no longer exceeded mc square, where m is the mass of that particular particle and c is the speed of light. One by one, massive particles became too heavy for the cooling universe. By combining with antiparticles, such heavy particles annihilated, converting into energy that then heated up the remaining light particles. The heavy particles thereby decoupled and essentially disappeared. But even though the universe's contents changed, nothing observable happened until a few minutes into the universe's Big Bang evolution. So we'll jump ahead to when the contents of the universe changed substantially and did so in a verifiable way. The Hubble expansion mentioned above was one confirmation of the Big Bang theory. Two other significant measurements, both involving the universe's contents, solidified physicists' confidence that it was correct. We'll first consider the prediction of the relative fractions of the different types of nuclei that were formed in the very early universe, which match pretty closely the densities that have been observed. A few minutes after the Big Bang, protons and neutrons stopped flying around in isolation. the temperature dropped sufficiently that these particles became bound into nuclei in which they were held together by strong nuclear forces. Also by that time, matter interactions that initially kept the number of protons and neutrons the same were no longer effective. Because neutrons could still decay into protons through the weak nuclear force, their relative number changed. Because neutron decay takes place sufficiently slowly, a substantial fraction of neutrons survived long enough to be absorbed into nuclei along with the protons that were present. Helium, deuterium, and lithium nuclei were then formed, and the cosmic relic amount of these elements, as well as of hydrogen, whose density was depleted when helium was created, was established. The residual amounts of different elements were set by the relative number of protons and neutrons, as well as by how quickly the required physical processes took place relative to the speed at which the universe expanded. So the predictions of nucleosynthesis, as this process is known, test the theory of nuclear physics as well as the details of the Big Bang expansion. In a significant confirmation of both the Big Bang theory and nuclear physics, observations agree with predictions spectacularly well. Not only did these measurements verify existing theories, but they constrain new ones too. That is because the expansion rate when nuclei abundances were established is mostly accounted for by the energy carried by the types of matter we already know about. Whatever new stuff existed at the time better not have contributed too much energy back then, or the expansion rate would have been too rapid. This constraint is important for me and my colleagues when we consider more speculative ideas for what can exist in the universe. Only small amounts of novel forms of matter could have been in equilibrium and had the same temperature as known matter at the time of nucleosynthesis. The success of these predictions also tells us that even today, the amount of ordinary matter cannot be much greater than what has been observed. Too much normal matter and the predictions of nuclear physics wouldn't match the observed heavy element abundances in the universe, along with the measurements described in the previous chapter, which tell us that luminous matter does not suffice to explain observations. The successful predictions of nucleosynthesis tell us that ordinary matter cannot account for all the observed matter in the universe, largely dispelling the hope that it was invisible just because it wasn't burning or reflective enough. If there were much more ordinary matter than is observed in luminous matter, the successful nuclear physics predictions would no longer apply unless there were some new ingredient. Unless ordinary matter can somehow hide during nucleosynthesis, we have to conclude that dark matter must exist. But perhaps the most significant milestone in the universe's evolution, at least in terms of detailed testing of cosmological predictions, occurred somewhat later on, about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. The universe was originally filled with both charged and uncharged particles. But at this later time, the universe had cooled sufficiently that positively charged nuclei combined with negatively charged electrons to form neutral atoms. From that time forward, the universe consisted of neutral matter, which is matter that carries no electric charge. For photons, the particles that communicate the force of electromagnetism, this sequestering of charged particles into atoms was a substantial change. In the absence of charged matter to deflect them, photons could traverse the universe unhindered. This meant that radiation and light from the early universe could reach us directly, essentially independent of any more complicated evolution in the universe that might occur later on. The background radiation we see today is the radiation that existed 380,000 years into the universe's evolution. This radiation is the same radiation that was present immediately after the universe began its Big Bang expansion, but it is now at a much lower temperature. The photons cooled, but they didn't disappear. The temperature of the radiation today is 2.73 Kelvin, which is extremely cold. The radiation's temperature is only a few degrees warmer than 0 Kelvin, also known as absolute zero, the coldest anything can be. The detection of this radiation was in some sense the smoking gun for the Big Bang theory, perhaps the most convincing evidence that the equations were correct. The German-born astronomer Arno Penzias and the American Robert Wilson accidentally discovered this cosmic microwave background radiation in 1963 while using a telescope at Bell Labs in New Jersey. Penzias and Wilson weren't actually looking for cosmological relics. they were interested in radio antennas as a way to do astronomy. Of course, Bell Labs, which was associated with a telephone company, was interested in radio waves too. But when Penzias and Wilson tried to calibrate their telescope, they recorded a uniform background noise, like static, that came from all directions and didn't change with the seasons. It never went away, so they knew they couldn't ignore it. Because it had no preferred direction, it couldn't be coming from nearby New York City, the sun, or the test of a nuclear weapon the previous year. After cleaning off the droppings from the pigeons nesting inside the telescope, they concluded it couldn't come from the pigeons' white dielectric material, as Penzias politely called it, either. Robert Wilson told me the story of how lucky they were in the timing of their discovery. They didn't know anything about the Big Bang, but the theoretical physicists Robert Dick and Jim Peebles at nearby Princeton University did. The Princeton physicists were in the process of designing an experiment to measure the relic radiation that they recognized was a crucial implication of the Big Bang theory when they discovered they had been scooped by the Bell Lab scientists who hadn't yet realized what they had found. Luckily for Penzias and Wilson, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology astronomer Bernie Burke, whom Robert Wilson described to me as his personal early internet, knew about both the Princeton research and also the mysterious finding of Penzias and Wilson. Burke put two and two together and clinched the connection by bringing the relevant players into contact. After consulting with the theoretical physicist Robert Dick, Penzias and Wilson recognized the import and value of what they had discovered. Along with the much earlier discovery of the Hubble expansion, this discovery of the background radiation, which subsequently earned the two Bell Lab physicists the Nobel Prize in 1978, clinched the Big Bang theory of a cooling, expanding universe. This was a lovely example of science in action. The research was done for a specific scientific purpose, but had ancillary technological and scientific benefits. The astronomers weren't looking for what they found, but because they were extremely technologically and scientifically skilled, they didn't dismiss their finding. The research, while looking for relatively small discoveries, resulted in a discovery with tremendously deep implications, which they found because others were simultaneously thinking about the big picture. The discovery by the Bell Lab scientists was accidental, but it forever changed the science of cosmology. Furthermore, within a few decades of its discovery, this radiation also helped advance major new insights into cosmology. In a spectacular achievement, detailed measurements of this radiation helped verify the predictions of cosmological inflation, in which an explosive stage of expansion occurs very early on. Cosmological inflation. Many scientific breakthroughs have emerged from an underlying debate about whether change happens gradually or suddenly, or even, as with our initial ignorance of the universe's expansion, if change happens at all. Although people frequently neglect the relevance of this important factor, accounting for the rate of change in today's world can be very useful when considering the consequences of technology, for example, or when evaluating environmental transformations. Debates about the pace of change underscored many of the central 19th century conflicts over Darwinian evolution, too. As we will see in Chapter 11, the debates contrasted gradualism as espoused by Charles Lyell in the case of geology, and his acolyte Charles Darwin with the arguments in favor of sudden geological changes posed by the Frenchman Georges Cuvier. Cuvier also recognized another kind of radical change, suggesting, controversially, that not only do new species emerge, as Darwin had so notably demonstrated, but that they also disappear through extinction. Debates about the pace of change were also central to our understanding of the development of the cosmos. With the universe, the first surprise was that it evolves at all. When the Big Bang theory was first proposed in the early 20th century, its implications were very different from those of the theologically favored static universe, which was what most people had accepted at the time. But another later surprise was the recognition that very early on, our universe underwent a phase of explosive expansion, cosmological inflation. As with life on Earth, both gradual and catastrophic processes played a role in the universe's history. For the universe, the catastrophe was inflation, And by catastrophe, I mean only that this phase occurred suddenly and rapidly. Inflation destroyed the contents of the universe that had been there initially, but it also created the matter that filled our universe when the explosive phase came to an end. The history presented so far is the standard Big Bang theory of an expanding, cooling, aging universe. It is remarkably successful, but it's not the whole story. Cosmological inflation occurred before the standard Big Bang evolution took over. Even though I cannot tell you what happened at the very beginning of the universe, I can say with reasonable certainty that at some time very early on in its evolution, perhaps as early as 10 to the minus 36 seconds in, this sensational event called inflation took place. Take a look at figure 5 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. During inflation, the universe expanded far more rapidly than it did during standard Big Bang evolution, most likely exponentially, so that the universe kept multiplying in size for the duration of this inflationary phase. Exponential expansion means, for example, that when the universe was 60 times older than when inflation began, the universe would have increased by more than a trillion trillion-fold, whereas without inflation, the universe's size would have increased only by a factor of 8. Once inflation ended, also only a fraction of a second into the universe's evolution, it left behind a large, smooth, flat, homogeneous universe whose later evolution is predicted by the traditional Big Bang theory. The inflationary explosion was in a sense the bang that started the cosmological evolution toward the smoother, slower evolution that was just described. Inflation diluted away the initial matter and radiation as the rapid cooling sent the temperature very close to zero. Hot matter was reintroduced only when the inflation ended and the energy driving inflation was converted to a tremendous number of elementary particles. The conventional, slower expansion took over when inflation ended. From this stage forward, the old Big Bang cosmology applies. The physicist Alan Guth developed the theory of inflation because the Big Bang theory, successful as it is, left several issues unresolved. Why, if a universe grew from an infinitesimally sized region, is there so much stuff contained within? And why has the universe been so long-lived? Based on the theory of gravity, you might have expected a universe containing so much stuff to have expanded away into nothingness or to have collapsed very quickly. Yet despite the enormous amount of matter and energy it contains, the three infinite spatial dimensions of the universe are very nearly flat, and the universe's evolution has been sufficiently slow for us to celebrate its 13.8 billion years of existence. One further major omission in the original Big Bang cosmology was an explanation for why the universe is so uniform. When the cosmic radiation we now observe was emitted, the universe was only about 1/1000th its current size, meaning that the distance light could have traveled was far smaller. Yet when observers view the radiation emitted from different regions of the sky from this time, the radiation appears to be identical, meaning that the deviations in temperature and density are minuscule. This is puzzling because according to the original Big Bang scenario, the age of the universe at the time when the cosmic radiation decoupled from charged matter was too low for light to have had enough time to travel even 1% of the way across the sky. That is to say, if you go back in time and ask whether the radiation that ends up in these separated patches of the sky could have ever sent or received any signals between them, the answer would be no. But if the separate regions never communicated with each other, why would they look the same? It would be as if you and 1,000 strangers from different places with different stores and different magazines as inspiration entered a theater dressed identically. If you never had any contact with each other or with shared media outlets, it would be a remarkable coincidence for you to all end up dressed alike. The sky's uniformity is even more remarkable, since the uniformity applies at a precision of 1 in 10,000. And it looks like the universe began with more than 100,000 regions that didn't communicate with each other. The idea that Guth proposed in 1980 seemed very attractive in light of these deficiencies. He suggested an early epoch during which the universe expanded extraordinarily rapidly. Whereas in the standard Big Bang scenario, the universe grew calmly and steadily, in the inflationary epoch, the universe underwent a phase of explosive expansion. According to the theory of cosmological inflation, the very early universe grew from a tiny region to an exponentially larger region in an extremely short period of time. The size of a region that a light ray could have crossed might have increased by a factor of a trillion trillion. Depending on when inflation began and how long it lasted, the original region a light ray could cross might have begun as 10 to the negative 29 meters in size, but expanded during inflation to be at least about a millimeter big, a little bigger than a piece of sand. With inflation, you do in some sense have the universe in a grain of sand, or at least in the size of a grain of sand, as William Blake would have you believe, if you measure the size of the universe as the observable region at that time. The inflationary universe's extremely rapid expansion explains the universe's enormity, uniformity, and flatness. The universe is enormous because it grew exponentially. In very little time, it became very big. An exponentially expanding universe covers far more territory than one expanding at the far slower rate of the original Big Bang scenario. The universe is uniform because the enormous expansion during inflation smoothed out the wrinkles in the space-time fabric, much as stretching out your jacket sleeve eliminates the creases in its fabric. With the inflationary universe, a single very small region in which everything was close enough to communicate via radiation grew into the universe we see today. Inflation also explains flatness. From a dynamical perspective, the flatness of the universe means that the density in the universe as a whole is at the borderline where it can last a very long time. Any larger energy density would have made for positive curvature of space, the kind of curvature that a sphere has, which would have made the universe quickly collapse. Any less density would have caused the universe to expand so rapidly that structure would never have coalesced and formed. Technically, I am overstating slightly. With a very tiny amount of curvature, the universe could have lasted as long as it has. But that curvature would have had to have been mysteriously small without inflation to justify its value. In an inflationary scenario, the universe is currently so large and flat because it grew so much early on. Imagine that you could blow up a balloon to be as large as you wanted. If you focus on some particular region of the balloon, you would see that it became flatter as the balloon grew larger. Similarly, people originally thought the Earth was flat because they saw only a small region of the surface of a much larger sphere. The same thing is true for the universe. It flattened as it expanded. The difference is that it expanded by a factor exceeding a trillion trillion. The extreme flatness of the universe was the chief confirmation of inflation. This might not come as a surprise, since flatness was, after all, one of the problems inflation was supposed to address. But at the time inflation was conceived, it was known that the universe was flatter than naive expectations would suggest, but with nowhere near the precision required to test inflation's extreme prediction. The universe has now been measured to be flat at the level of a percent. Had this not been true, inflation would have been ruled out. When I was a graduate student in the 1980s, inflation was considered an interesting idea, but not one that most particle physicists took very seriously. From a particle physics point of view, the circumstances required for a long-lived exponential expansion seemed extremely unlikely. In fact, they still do. Inflation was supposed to address the naturalness of the initial conditions for the expansion of the universe. But if inflation itself is unnatural, the problem isn't really solved. The question of how inflation occurred, its underlying physics model, remains a matter of speculation. The model-building issues that plagued us in the 1980s are still a concern. On the other hand, people like Andrei Linde, a Russian-born physicist now at Stanford, who was one of the first to work on inflation, thought it had to be correct even when the idea was first proposed, simply because no one had found any other solutions to the puzzles of size, flatness, and homogeneity which inflation was able to solve in one fell swoop. In light of recent detailed measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation, most physicists now agree. Despite the fact that we have yet to determine the theoretical underpinnings of inflation, and that inflation happened long ago, it leads to testable predictions, which have convinced most of us that inflation, or something very similar to inflation, has occurred. The most precise of these observations concerned details about the 2.73-degree background radiation that Penzias and Wilson had discovered. NASA's Cosmic Background Explorer, COBE, measured this same radiation, but more comprehensively and over a large range of frequencies, establishing its